Welcome to Talking Plants on RN Summer. I'm Tim Entwistle. After last week's fake plants, today it's back to the real world and to what makes an Australian garden. You're going to meet two landscape designers with wildly different approaches to designing with Australian plants. For one, it's about recreating a natural setting. For the other, it's about using Australian plants to surprise, to shock and to challenge. Plus, another mystery plant goes under the Talking Plants microscope. And for my weekly journey outdoors, it's to the far west corner of Australia I'm taking you today, to the backyard of a botanist.
Just coming upon a central area, wall to wall with seven different species of kangaroo paw. And I've been interested in kangaroo paws as a model group to try and get at the question of how has the flora of southwestern Australia ended up with so many species when the place is relatively flat as a landscape, and yet it's the second richest temperate flora on the planet.
Before the floral diversity of Western Australia, and before we dive into the world of Australian garden design, Jim Fogarty has something in his elegant red brocade box. Ready for the big reveal, Jim.
Tim, now this one is a bit of a favourite of mine. As you open the box now, you'll see. I'll start with a bit of a clue. It's an upright Australian tree with a dense crown.
So we have something with green. I always start by saying it has green leaves, which is going to be pretty safe. But also these leaves are a little bit curved. They've got a soft sort of round end on them. And this is a branch off a big tree or a shrub?
Yeah, it's a big tree, Tim. So now you're talking about the leaves. Now these leaves are actually not leaves. Technically, are they? They're phyllodes.
That's right. They've got a little tiny gland at the bottom of them, which I think produces some sort of honey or attractant. And if we look at those lines or veins through them, there's lots and lots of parallel veins.
It grows naturally in sort of rich soil and often found along creeks and waterways.
Yeah, I know. And these, what did you call them? You call them phyllodes. Okay. It's really a stem that's got flattened out.
Right. It's a modified stem, isn't it?
That's correct. There's a little bit of a remaining flower on the end of it, Jim, but nothing pretty.
No. So the flowers are little sort of yellow balls. That's a pretty good clue too. And they'll occur often in spring.
I think this is pretty obviously a wattle, so we might just get to the crux of this. I'm wondering which kind of wattle. In Australia, there are maybe, 700 different species of wattle, and it is really one of those iconic Australian genera.
Yeah, okay, so it's very much a bird-attracting tree. You can use the foliage to lather up into a soap. All you need is a little bit of water. The other clue is the timber is very closely grained, and it's often used for furniture making, for making tools, but also for making guitars.
Right.
So in the genus, so this is an acacia. The common name is the blackwood, and the reveal is that it's Acacia melanoxylon, and it is one of the longer living forms of acacia.
But very tall, though.
It grows very tall, yeah. I mean, in domestic garden, it will grow about 10-odd metres, but you'll get 20 metres probably out in the wild. And it grows taller in the cooler areas, so places like Tasmania.
But in your gardens, would you tend to encourage wattles, or people are worried about them sort of falling over and lasting a short time?
Well, the timber's very hard on this one. So, as I say, it does last a longer time. It is good for domestic gardens because you get a nice dense crown on it. It's a very attractive feature or specimen tree. But the beauty is, too, it will tolerate drought, but it also tolerates wet, boggy soils.
Okay. Now, look, I suspect this is going to be used by our two designers today. So I might move to our panel discussion, which is actually about Australian plants in the garden. And whether you imitate the beauty of nature or you create a more contrived but beautiful setting. We have with us Kate Cullity from Taylor Cullity Lethlean, based in Adelaide but doing work all over Australia, including, in fact, the Australian Garden at Cranbourne, which is part of the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, which I head up. Hi, Kate.
Hi there, Tim.
And Sam Cox of Sam Cox Landscape, a Victorian-based company that's done some inspiring work in Castlemaine in central Victoria, a place where I actually went to school for a few years. Hi, Sam.
Hello, Tim.
Now, Kate Cullity, you spoke recently in the US about drought and beauty. Are you saying we can create beauty in the face of drought in our gardens?
Yes, I am. And in a sense, we should always be prepared for drought, because just like the Aboriginal people who didn't necessarily see drought and as adversity, they just saw it part of the rhythm of the environment. I believe that if we have a different thought about our environment, we need to look at the inspiration of the natural landscape of Australia and imbue that into our own gardens.
Now, Sam, what's your sort of gardening response, I guess, to drought? Would it be similar?
Yeah, I don't consider drought as being extraordinary anymore. I actually think that's the normal. So now we prepare our gardens for dry periods. My career's coming up to its 20th year, and I've had 2 years of above-average rainfall in southeast Australia. So I consider drought as being normal, and if we have a good season above average, we celebrate.
Now, I think both of you approach this, so you're both really, really tackling the same problem, but I think you end up with different solutions. But before we get to that, Jim, you're a garden designer, of course, yourself, and I'm wondering whether you've changed your approach with changes in the weather.
Whenever I hear the word drought, I also think of the word flooding rains. And it's interesting, the last sort of 10 years, people went over the top with their drought planning. But then when we got the heavy rains that does inevitably come at some point, a lot of the plants drowned or rotted. So, yeah, I think it's important to consider both aspects, actually.
Yeah. Now, Kate, your landscapes are what probably people would call modern or distinct from natural landscapes. So I wouldn't mind, can you describe for me the kind of aesthetics or your approach to garden design generally, not just drought, but overall?
In a project like the Australian Garden, we're interested in the more artistic approach, a little bit like artists who abstract a landscape. So we're interested in ideas of taking the wonder and beauty of the Australian landscape and then distilling it into forms that express that.
So tell me a bit more about that.
A little bit like a Fred Williams painting that is dots and dashes and has a very staccato feeling. So that's abstracting landscape. So, for example, the sand garden, which is the first garden that you come across at the Australian Garden, which is expressing the sublime quality of the desert. And we were particularly interested in abstracting a sense of what it's like to be in the desert, what it's like to be with the red sand and the spinifex that are dotted through that landscape, where every plant sort of sits in its own shadow. So the way that we've composed that garden is in an abstracted sculptural sense. So there's large circles of a blue-green plant called rugosa or saltbush, and that's interspersed with a ground plane of red sand. And then in the middle of the garden, there's a strong, long line that is composed of ephemeral plants. So often in spring, there's flowering, everlasting yellow daisies. And that line is expressing ideas about the European explorers and their use of the compass travelling north.
It's incredibly evocative. And as you say, it says so much about the flora and about the country. Sam, I might bring you in. You're building on the ideas of people like Edna Walling, Ella Stones and Gordon Ford. And these are people who have designed more with a kind of natural garden. So you really want to complement and emulate the natural landscape. Is that quite different to what Kate's talking about?
In a way it is, but then it's similar. I suppose my clients tend to be looking for a sense of place. So we are continually looking to give people a feel of being in that environment that quite often we have to go and visit. National parks have been locked up as a place to preserve, and we go and visit them and we're in awe of nature. Now, my view is we can bring elements of that, and this is where it's similar, bring elements of that into a living space. The way we go about that is through naturalism, though. So we look to emulate nature. We don't pretend that we're simulating or building nature by any way. This is a built form, obviously, but we are emulating nature using natural materials in a natural sense.
Sam, Jim here, you don't really do plans. Is that your way of controlling or trying not to control the gardens? Is that how you sort of achieve that wild, natural look?
My training was with Gordon Ford, and 95% of his work was without plants. So it was a very instinctive approach to work. It did allow for that that ability to move with the garden, I suppose, until you are on a property or get a sense of a property, and it may take a few days to really get a sense of it. You cannot completely define what you're going to do in that space. Now, we work with consultation with the clients and obviously some trust, but we find that that gets the results for us using that instinctive approach.
Would you argue that something like the natural beauty of the bush can't really be surpassed? Are you trying to do something that's better?
Look,
than?
I think we consider the national parks and what we consider as wild beauty as being the pinnacle, I suppose, in Australia. People spend a lot of time driving to national parks and camping and absorbing that nature. Now, I believe we can bring essence of that into gardens, livable spaces, comfortably.
And Kate, why do you create something different when, say, the Australian vegetation and landscape is so beautiful in the first place?
Why do we not emulate the Australian landscape?
Yeah.
That is something of itself, and it has its own elemental force.
I think the way I see it, you're actually pulling out more and giving someone a fresh way they can look at the landscape.
Yeah, we're pulling out the essence of it. Having said that, I admire enormously Sam's very beautiful gardens and that whole bush school movement. We, in a sense, are just interested in looking at it from a different artistic lens, that we're able to express something about that landscape, just as an artist expresses in often a very minimalist way, very powerful notions about a landscape.
Jim, I remember one of your garden designs at Hampton Court Palace where, and probably this is true of a lot of the ones you've done in show gardens, where you create a very formal garden, but they win prizes because of the sort of naturalistic feel or the fact that Australian plants are a little bit scrappy and untidy. Do you see that sort of almost a contradiction there that helps your gardens?
Well, possibly. I mean, Australian plants are still very exotic to the international gardener or European gardener. And obviously, very contrived when you're doing a show because you've got everything flowering at once, and that's not really going to happen in the Australian landscape. And I think what Kate and Taylor Callady-Lethine do very well is I think they introduce a sculptural element to their gardens and they sort of reference landforms. So it's not all about the horticulture.
Now, that brings me actually to sort of risk-taking generally, and I wouldn't mind, Sam, your view on this first. Do you think there's room for more risk?
Oh, look, we have to push some clients out of their comfort zone of what it is to live in a natural space, I suppose. A lot of people grow up in an urban environment or a suburban environment where their worldview is structured from their time growing up. So it's the paling fences, it's the, you know, the bit of lawn in the middle of the backyard. Now, if I get my way, I won't have any lawn in a garden if possible, unless there are children involved and it's going to get used. I'll remove grass altogether, purely because we can't maintain grass to a good level in Victoria because of the lack of rainfall. So we're asking people to make their shift, I suppose, from how they would consider their time spent in a garden. We do test people every now and then, but what we do find is we have an opportunity to ask people to change the way they live, possibly outside as well, which is exciting.
Now, Kate, what about you in terms of taking risks? I know you take amazing risks in a sense because you're creating new things. What are some of the big risks you've taken?
We take a risk in that we have done a lot of different types of projects. And about 5 years ago, we sat around and thought, what are our sticky projects? Meaning, what are the projects that mean the most to us? And what we realised was that they were the ones that were the first of their kind, where we really jumped off the deep end. So the Australian Garden was the first botanic garden that we did. And Collingwood Children's Farm, which is a wonderful farm in the city in Melbourne, was the first, not the first community project that we'd done, but the first really highly charged political project, the most political project we've ever done. And that was because we were trying to keep a bike track from going through the middle of the farm. But what we find is that we're also big collaborators. We love working with other people. I really see design as a social art, and we've been really fortunate to work with lots of different people from different disciplines, artists, curators, historians, writers. So we jump off the deep end, but then we learn how to swim really well by having other people who who help us along the way.
So rather than risk, it's more being open to ideas by the sound of it. So, Jim, what about for the home gardener who can't really afford a garden designer, but they want to introduce something a little bit intriguing or take a bit of a risk in their garden? How would they do it?
I think if you're talking about Australian plants, the key is the structural elements of the garden. So it might be as simple as the shape of a path or even a deck to introduce that sculptural element that always provides an aesthetic in your garden, even when the Australian plants are looking a bit scrappy or a bit wiry or out of season.
So it can be something fairly simple. It doesn't have to be expensive and doesn't have to be complicated, but it's really looking, and it's something in addition to the plants.
Well, it is, and I think that's the key with Australian plants, having something that backs it up. And as I say, if you're looking at some sort of strong shape that is a bit more iconic to our environment as well, and it might be as basic as a gravel path. It's very easy to do yourself, but it's just not something that's necessarily a straight line path that always looks good, whatever the season.
I do think we really need more beautiful gardens by designers such as our three guests here today. Kate Cullity from Taylor Cullity Lethlean, Sam Cox from Sandcox Landscape, and of course, Jim Fogarty. Do stay with us and I'll get your laurel or your thorn of the week after a brief trip outdoors. This time it's to the far southwest corner of Australia. It's twilight in the beachside garden near Albany in Western Australia.
My name's Steve Hopper. I'm Professor of Biodiversity at the University of Western Australia's Albany campus. And we're standing in our front yard at a place called Good Beach, which is on King George Sound.
Where are we? 400 kilometres south of Perth?
Yeah, we're very close to the southernmost part of WA on Tawndirrup Peninsula, south of Albany Town. A very famous place from the point of view of Australian history and exploration. This is where Vancouver landed in 1791. It's where the Flinders expedition first touched Australian soil. So literally within 2 kilometres of where we are, Tim, is where Robert Brown, the father of Australian botany, first set foot on the soil and first collected Australian plants.
Now, before we get to botany, you've been director of Kings Park Botanic Garden at Perth. You were director of Kew Gardens in London. You've also been, throughout that time and before and after that, working on a whole range of books and publications on the Australian flora, but particularly with a focus on this region. So it is the plants that drew you back here?
The plants, the country, family. This is, to me, like heaven and earth in terms of someone interested in field biology. This precinct around Albany sits on the edge of a global biodiversity hotspot.
It's a tremendous place and we can hear the sea in the background. And we're in your garden here, your private garden. So out beyond, of course, is the amazing West Australian flora. But there's a genus I know you've worked a lot on, and I don't know whether we're going to see any of those in here or not, but the kangaroo paws, do you have any of those in this garden here?
I sure do. We're just coming upon a central area, wall to wall, with 7 different species of kangaroo paw. And I've been interested in, since my PhD 40 years ago, in the kangaroo paws as a model group to try and get at the question of how has the flora of southwestern Australia ended up with so many species when the place is relatively flat as a landscape. There's no relatively few mountains, the Stirling Range, but most of the southwest is this gently rising plateau. And yet it's the second richest temperate flora on the planet, second to the Cape region of South Africa, as far as I'm aware. So why is it so? How could you end up with this tremendous diversity? Kangaroo paws are only found in southwestern Australia. In a native sense, they're planted all over the world now in the horticultural palette of Mediterranean climates in particular. When I started, there were 8 or 9 species recognised. I named a new one. We'd done recent DNA work with colleagues at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew and discovered there's 2 more new undescribed species here on the south coast. And one of the features that kangaroo paws differ in is the height of the flowering scape. So you get lots of little fellas that are called cat's paws or dwarf kangaroo paws, that sort of thing. And then the state floral emblem, the red and green kangaroo paw, is higher. It's about 1 metre higher compared to 30 centimetres. And what I discovered in my PhD with a colleague looking at honeyeaters was the smaller ones, the honeyeaters stand on the ground to get the nectar. And the bigger ones, like the red and green kangaroo paw, they perch on the stem. And at one place called Gingin Cemetery, where 2 species were coexisting with a few hybrids, common cat's paw and the red and green kangaroo paw, they differ in their flowering peak by a month. So in August, cat's paws are peaking, and the honey eaters spent 97% of their time on the ground. Even if there was a red and green kangaroo paw above them, they wouldn't jump up onto that. They'd stay on the ground and just feed on cat's paws for 97% of the movements. A month later, when the red and green kangaroo paws were peaking and the cat's paws were running out of steam, they would do the reverse. 97% of the time they'd be perched on the kangaroo paw stems and they would hop or fly to the next red and green kangaroo paw, even if there was a flowering cat's paw down at ground level.
So you've got two plants very closely associated with their pollinators, which is not an unusual thing. Well, in orchids, I know you've done a lot of work on the same thing happens there. And take us back to how this explains the diversity of the flora in southwest Western Australia.
What's going on is the plants are working out how they can ensure that their pollen mostly goes onto individuals of their own species by having differential height. So they're playing on the fact that the birds want to expend most of the time as least amount of energy as possible in getting their food, the nectar, from the flowers. So it makes a lot of sense. If you've got a predominant ground-flowering species, you stay on the ground and you ignore that thing that's up higher because that's a lot more energy to fly or jump up and land on it than it is just hopping along the ground to the next cat's paw. So if you like, the plants have worked that out in a metaphorical way. I'm not suggesting they've got consciousness, but through natural selection, you get these dwarf things and taller things for perch feeding. And as we started looking at the West Australian flora, you find the same thing. There are prostrate banksias, for example, and there are shrubby or tree banksias. There are prostrate grevilleas, and there are shrubby or tree grevilleas. Prostrate verticordias, and it goes on and on. All, I think, doing the same thing. So it's an example of how, even though the number of pollinators might be limited, you can end up being different species and getting more or less exclusive pollinator service by varying your floral attributes.
Well, as always, Stephen, it's probably just whetted my appetite for a few more questions, but we better leave it there. This is Professor Stephen Hopper at Good Bay and looking at some kangaroo paws, but hearing a lot about the wonderful West Australian flora. Thanks very much, Steve.
Great pleasure, Tim.
And all that from an incredibly pretty garden. And I have to say, the beach and the native bushland just outside was absolutely breathtaking there near Albany in Western Australia. Now, before we go today, a highlight or lowlight in the world of plants and gardens from each of our guests. Sam Cox, what's your laurel or thorn of the week?
Well, look, I've stepped away from gardens a little bit and I've been recently reading Robin Boyd's book, The Australian Ugliness, again. And he's talking about featureism, and it's a bit disheartening, I suppose, that Australia still has this obsession with featureism after 50 years.
Yeah. Does that mean you hate water features?
No. Look, we build water features, but I wouldn't call them water features. We build water into gardens. Now, the featureism I'm considering is a sort of overstated, I suppose.
Right.
And our work, we continually try and be understated, I suppose, and create that simplicity, but we find there is still a culture of a need to compete or to express, I suppose, wealth.
Okay, Kate Cullity, and a laurel or thorn from you?
My laurel is when I go to Western Australia. I was brought up in Western Australia, and Kings Park was a really important part of my childhood. And the way in which the Western Australian flora does grow on such impoverished soils and yet has such great abundance. So there's a wonderful garden bed that never disappoints me just near the visitors' centre that is full of kangaroo paws and dampieras, those beautiful blue delicate plants.
It's one of the most beautiful botanic gardens in Australia. And, of course, Steve Hopper, who we heard from, was a director there for a while. Jim, what about your laurel or thorn?
Well, my laurel is the National Arboretum Canberra, which was designed by Taylor Cullity Leslin. Of course, Kate is part of that team. A fantastic piece of Australian contemporary landscape artwork, if you like. A brilliant playground for children. And they're building a gallery of gardens. There'll be one done by Open Gardens Australia. There'll be designed by Neil Hobbs. And I'm involved in an Indigenous garden that would depict a Dreamtime story of Mununja the butterfly with Garawana Creative and Tyrone Bell, who's an animal elder.
All right, that's a local story of the Canberra region.
Correct, yeah. It's a story that's maybe 50,000 years old that would be brought to life in a
just
garden.
Just a recent story. Good. Something current. Well, that's it for Talking Plants this week. Thanks, Sam Cox.
Thanks, Tim.
Kate Cullity.
Thanks, Tim.
And, of course, our regular guest, Jim Fogarty.
Thanks, Tim.
Next week, for the final in this summer series, you'll meet three creative minds who draw inspiration from trees, one of them quite literally. That's next week on Talking Plants on RN. And if you want to hear any of the previous episodes, go to the RN website, abc.net.au/RN. From the drop-down list of programs, choose Talking Plants. You'll see there you can stream or download the audio. I'm Tim Entwistle.